You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Lachlan Balfour toko ingoa, no mai, haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Thursday Wire for Rapare, Thursday the 3rd of May. How time, we're already in May.
I know.
It's shocking. It's Lachlan, your host, and I'm joined today by producers Ben and Jemima. How are you both doing?
We're doing good.
Good, thank you.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yep, it's pretty much. Do you want more from us? Well,
no, nice sunny day.
It is, but it's a bit cold here in the studio.
It's always cold in the studio. It's a little fun fact for the listeners.
Yeah, you know, you don't get to experience it, but we do. The things we suffer through.
I would say 17 degrees.
But what you will not be suffering through is this wire, because it's so great. First up, I speak with Professor Claudia Geringer about the Electoral Integrity Amendment Bill. Neutral Corner returns, where Ben takes us through the reaction to the Korean armistice talks. Jemima speaks with Miles Ferris, president of Te Akatia, the Māori Principals Association, about biases against Māori in the education system. Andrew Little joins me for our regular chat. We discuss his recent visit to Ngāti Maru and the visit by Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan. And finally, this day in history looks at police violence during the Birmingham, Alabama marches in 1963. Hia ha ofakado. If you have any thoughts to share throughout the show, we would love to hear from you. Tuku pātui mai, send through a text 5395 or YMI. You can call the studio to chat with one of us, likely me because my producers refuse to answer the phone, on 309-3879. Tukua te poti ki te pai te ho. Don't forget to vote in our Twitter poll on @95BFMNews. What is our poll?
Our poll today is, will the peace talks in Korea lead to either nothing, denuclearization, reunification, or something else? And please reply. Yeah,
how's
that
looking so far? Looking like a good poll?
Currently, 40% denuclearization. That's the highest one we've got so far.
Well, let us know what you think. But for now,
Irirangi Po, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
As part of Labour's coalition deal with New Zealand First, they promised to support the so-called Waka Jumping Bill. The bill would allow a party leader to expel an MP if they believe the MP has acted in a way to distort political party proportionality and if they have the support of two-thirds of the MPs in the party. The bill has been roundly criticised as going against the Bill of Rights Act and is seen as undemocratic. I spoke with Professor Claudia Geringer from Victoria University about the bill and the problems with it. I began by asking her to explain why the government feels the need to introduce the bill.
Well, they say that it will enhance the integrity of the public confidence in the integrity of the electoral system and also the principle of proportionality. I'm very sceptical, particularly about the first claim. I think it actually undermines electoral integrity. Can I perhaps start by acknowledging, you know, why it's so, this idea that we legalise, we legislate to throw defecting MPs out of Parliament is so attractive. I mean, it really does sound like a good idea, doesn't it? Because under the MMP system, you know, we parties are elected to Parliament with a certain percentage of the vote, and it feels really wrong and unfair for a foot soldier in one of those parties to then change their minds and abandon ship. And in many cases, that is, you know, that's right. But the problem is that when we look at it more carefully, it turns out that not all cases are that simple, and that party hopping legislation might solve some problems, but it creates others. So can I give you a couple of examples?
Yeah, yeah.
So in 2004, Tariana Turia left the Labour Party in the face of widespread dissatisfaction amongst Labour's Māori voters about Labour's sponsorship of the Foreshore and Seabed Act. Now, this was under the old party hopping legislation, so she was forced to resign from Parliament and stand at a by-election. If she'd been a List MP, she wouldn't have had that option. But it's far from clear in that case that her resignation could be regarded as unscrupulous, regardless of whether or not she'd been a List or a party or an electorate MP. So another example, and this one I think is actually even more pertinent, under MMP, it's in the way of things that, particularly in the second half of the electoral cycle, MPs are going to want to start repositioning themselves for the next electoral context. contest. And sometimes that may involve new parties emerging, new ones forming out of old ones and so on. That's what happened in 2002 when Jim Anderton wanted to establish the Progressive Coalition Party. And the party hopping legislation created this sort of bizarre situation where he had to sort of pretend to remain in the Parliamentary Alliance Party while campaigning under a different banner. So the point is that not all political defections are unscrupulous. And indeed, the vitality of our system relies on a degree of healthy political realignment during the course of the electoral cycle.
I mean, are there actually that many defections in New Zealand?
Because no.
It doesn't
so
seem to happen terribly often.
Exactly. It happened a little bit at the beginning, as you'd expect, when MMP first came in and everyone was kind of jostling to sort of sort out where they'd sit. There were a few defections, but there are almost, you know, it's just not a problem. And that's the other side of it, that it's a heavy-handed intervention for something that just isn't a problem in New Zealand. And in some countries where this kind of legislation has been promoted, party hopping is a huge problem. So, for example, there's a much-cited example from India between the fourth and fifth general elections in 1967, between 1967 and 1972, from among 4,000 members in various federal and state legislatures, there were nearly 2,000 cases of defection and counter-defection.
Wow.
And that was what provided that. Now, and that, there's no doubt, is there, that you've got a problem with electoral integrity.
Yeah.
Like that's massive corruption on a massive scale. And you would expect a heavy-handed intervention. In New Zealand, we don't have that problem. On the other hand, this kind of legislation does create other problems, and that's why I oppose it.
And you've also criticised the bill as contravening the Bill of Rights Act. And how does it do this?
Yeah, so perhaps the bit that we haven't got to in terms of the evils of the legislation is the way that it essentially chills internal party debate and chills dissent within parties. So effectively it's allowing the party to expel a member, not just from the party, but effectively from Parliament, if they're creating problems. So it places a lot of power in the hands of party hierarchies and chills dissent. And for that reason, everybody accepts that this legislation is a limit, both on the right to freedom of association, but also on the right to freedom of expression, because of this chilling effect on political dissent. Now, my view is it's difficult to argue that it's a reasonable limit, really for the reasons we've just given, which is that it's not needed. It's a heavy-handed solution to a problem that doesn't really exist. And for that reason, you can't really say that the limit on those rights is justified.
So this would apply to backbench MPs as well as cabinet
higher-ups? It applies to anyone that gets on the wrong side of the party hierarchy, potentially.
As you mentioned, there was a similar bill in place from 2001 to 2005. Did we see a lot of problems with this bill when it was in effect?
Well, it's hard to see the problems because you don't know what behaviour is being chilled. You don't know who might have raised some issues about legislation they didn't support or that felt that they couldn't behave in a dissenting manner because this legislation was in place. You certainly saw the situation that I just described, for example, of Tariana Turia having to stand at a by-election, which everybody knew she was going to get re-elected. It cost the taxpayer an awful lot of money to hold that by-election, and it really was a situation where you would have thought in the circumstances that she had a mandate simply to stay in the House.
Does our political system, MMP, does it make party hopping easier? Is there some kind of reason for it in this sense, or not really?
Only in the sense that it's a multi-party parliament, and so in a sense we would expect there to be more healthy political realignment as part of the process. So we don't just have two parties. There is always going to be the possibility of new parties forming, and that's not a bad thing, that's potentially a good thing, right? But when new parties form, they often form out of existing parties. So party splits, party mergers, that kind of activity is actually a perfectly healthy activity in a democracy. It's probably going to be a little bit more common under a multi-party system.
And you also said it's a harmful extension of legal regulation into the political arena. Can you discuss this a bit?
I guess the point being that, you know, I started by acknowledging that in many cases, political defections may be unscrupulous. But the first question before you sort of come in with a law is, are there other ways to regulate the conduct? And my view would be that this is conduct that is actually being well controlled by political incentives. In other words,
there are sort of measures in place.
Well, MPs ultimately care about what the public think about them. And MPs know that, on the whole, New Zealand voters don't think that this is scrupulous behaviour. They don't want their MPs defecting. And MPs are well aware of that. And this is a control. And I would suggest that it must be an effective control. Political sanctions must be effective because we see so little of this behaviour.
And just finally, do you think the bill will still go through, despite the clear opposition to it?
I really have no idea. I have absolutely no idea. Obviously, New Zealand First want it. Labour have made a commitment to supporting it for that reason. I guess the Greens are the wild card.
Yeah, the Greens, that's sort of an odd one, because they were very opposed to similar legislation before, weren't they?
They were, but in the end, it's all about, you know, what you're prepared to give away in order to be part of a coalition. And you know, we all understand that if you're a coalition government, then there's going to be some rats that you have to swallow. And the question is, you know, how big a rat is this, and are the Greens going to be prepared to swallow it?
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
And now it's time for Neutral Corner with Ben Goldson.
That was North Korean state television reporting on a historic meeting between Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un and South Korean President Moon Jae-in. This comes after months of tension between the North and American President Donald Trump, who had vowed to take a harder line than previous administrations. So, on a network which broadly aligns with the Trump administration, Fox News, the news was taken as proof that tough talk works.
We begin with President Trump on the verge of a truly historic diplomatic triumph as his tough talk appears to be paying off. The leaders of North and South Korea, this was wild, agreed in principle today to remove all nuclear weapons from their countries and to work toward formally ending the state of war that has existed since the 1953 truce. Trump was ecstatic over the news, tweeting early in the day, "Korean War to end." The president later acknowledged there was much work to be done, but he sure sounded optimistic. So is it time for Trump's critics to concede that his tough rocket man talk on the sanctions, North Korea, actually made a difference here? Republican Congressman Luke Messer has been urging colleagues to support, wait for it, a Nobel Peace Prize for the president. He joins us now from Fort Wayne, Indiana, and former Trump campaign advisor and China policy expert Mike Pillsbury is going to be with us, as is Asia policy expert Riley Walters of the Heritage Foundation. Great panel. I never thought I would see this in my lifetime, I have to say, guys. Yeah. The idea of the North Korean dictator crossing the DMZ to meet the South Korean leader, obviously speaking the same language, meeting together, embracing at one point after the handshake, after they had their meeting. Again, this is initial still in its initial phases, but Congressman, I have to say, I think the only person who could have gotten us to this place, again, we'll see where it goes, but it's Donald Trump, because of his unconventional approach to negotiations. And frankly, his tough talk, you didn't know if people were going to say, "You're going to launch a nuclear war, unilateral first strike, Mr. President." He's like, "No, but we're going to solve this." Congressman, how did Donald Trump manage to get us this far?
That was Fox News host Laura Ingraham from the Ingraham Angle discussing peace talks between the two Koreas.
Yeah, I mean, this peace prize thing for Trump, but just thinking about it, because, of course, Obama got one, didn't he?
Yeah, famously.
Right after he bombed the ever-loving shit out of the Middle East. So,
bit of a pattern.
I mean, plus, the thing with Trump,
just give them to anyone these days.
Yeah, it's almost like
throwing them away.
You could give him that to just keep him happy, because he probably could sabotage all this. if he just decides, no, I'm not getting the respect.
You don't think he's actually going to get one?
No, but I think it could be a good way of keeping him happy and keeping him from ruining the deal. Because he probably could sabotage it, like I said. This America can still, I don't know, do some big military deployment off the coast of South Korea. And that'll sort of piss the North off.
Mm.
Who's
in our other corner, though?
Well, I still had a bit of stuff to say about Fox News. Just how the panel, of course, broadly reflected the conservative viewpoint. You know, they had a Republican, I think, congressperson, a former Trump advisor, someone from the Heritage Foundation, which is a sort of right-wing think tank. So as such, they made a pretty big deal out of the meeting. This is a big step. And I was also saying, I think partly this reflects just the average age of the Fox viewer, which I looked up as 68, which actually means they would have been born in 1950, which, interesting enough, is the year that the Korean War started. So it's sort of presented as this big, you know, this is that big historical thing that it's come to an end.
We'll see, though, won't we?
And also, they've probably done it just because you've got the upcoming midterms. Mm. So you have to validate Trump's approach, as, like I said, the tough talk sort of rhetoric. However, this was received somewhat differently on CGTN television.
Leaders from the two Koreas take a historic step in efforts to bring peace to the peninsula. We'll bring you reaction from Beijing and Washington. Hello, I'm Anand Naidu, and this is The Heat. It was a remarkable moment when DPRK leader Kim Jong-un met with Republic of Korea President Moon Jae-in Friday in the demilitarized zone for the inter-Korean summit. The leaders at times acted like old friends and pledged to work for the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula and pursue talks with the United States and China to bring an official end to the Korean War. We begin our coverage with CGTN's Jack Barton from the demilitarized zone. And Jack, the talks between the two leaders were historic but short on specifics. What was accomplished and what comes next?
Well, a lot was accomplished, even if it was in broad terms, particularly for the Korean people here. The denuclearization deal is really the international headline grabber, and it's very important here. It's the number one issue, but almost on par with that would be this commitment to seek a peace agreement that could finally end the Korean War, that sort of major hostilities ending back in 1953 with an armistice, a ceasefire, but that's it. And that would enable them to start demilitarizing the heavily militarized demilitarized zone, which you'd be able to see behind me if it weren't for the mist this morning. That could start with taking heavy weapons back away from the DMZ, reducing that constant threat that really Koreans on both sides of the DMZ feel whenever hostilities do occasionally flare up again. Also, the commitment for family reunions, and a date's been now given for that in August, bringing children from the war back together again, if only very briefly, for those very emotional reunions we've seen. Now, it is a lot of goodwill. The skeptics amongst the analysts, though, saying this is really insurance building by Kim Jong-un in the same way as his visit to China, trying to sort of build goodwill in China and South Korea so that if there is talk again of preemptive strikes from the US, he sort of has allies in his corner, also perhaps allies in his corner calling for sanctions to maybe be eased at the start or during talks and not at the very end, as Donald Trump would wish.
Jack, prior to this summit, the DPRK suspended some of its missile tests and shut down one of its nuclear sites. What do we know about Kim's intentions for that nuclear arsenal?
Well, we do know that he doesn't want to give it all up. In fact, he'd like to keep most of it. That's what South Korean officials were saying before the negotiations even began yesterday. Kim is sort of looking at the international model. I mean, all of the big major nuclear powers, including the US and China, signed up to the Non-Proliferation Treaty back in the Cold War. One of the tenets there is denuclearization, but of course everyone still has their weapons. That's the kind of schedule that Pyongyang is looking for. Donald Trump, of course, looking for a very specific timeline, a short timeline, with rewards at the end of it, and a short timeline, we've heard, so that there can't be backsliding or progress on a nuclear program while the talks are ongoing. Kim Jong-un looking for a much longer timeline with reciprocal relationship along the way. So if they give up something, they get something in return. But we're going to have to see how this progresses with the potential meeting between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. Donald Trump clearly looking at the 2020 midterms, trying to get some achievements in place before then. Kim Jong-un no doubt hoping that perhaps Donald Trump is no longer on the scene when the negotiations reach fruition, and he probably has someone not quite as hawkish to deal with at that result. But really, this is the beginning of a long process. As you say, no real details in the agreement. There's no time frame. There's no specifics on what is going to be put in mothballs or taken apart. But it's the beginning. It's the first step.
Thanks, Jack. That's CGTN's Jack Bock.
And that was China Global Television Network's The Heat, as you heard there. So they were generally sort of more measured in their approach to the news, generally treating it like a bit less of a big deal, like it's still, there's a lot of stumbling blocks. Denuclearization, probably less ambitious than it's been presented in America, especially on Fox News. And of course, there was their sort of minimizing of the role of Trump in getting us this far, or getting the Koreas this far.
We'll have to see.
We will have to see.
See what happens. But thank you, Ben, for another great segment. Ko te waia, tēnei marunga, BFM. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. If you have any thoughts to share, please send through a text to 5395 or call us on 309-3879. We'll be right back with Miles Ferris to talk about the biases faced by Māori in the education system. But for now, here's a little break.
Power Station. Go. From Wes Anderson, director of the Grand Budapest Hotel, comes Isle of Dogs.
That boy flew here all alone to find his dog.
It's an adventure unlike anything you've seen before.
You're looking for your lost dog Spots. Does anybody know him?
No. Wherever he is, we'll find him.
With an all-star voice cast including Jeff Goldblum, Bryan Cranston, Edward Norton and Scarlett Johansson, you'd be barking mad to miss it. Isle of Dogs in cinemas now. Rated PG, contains violence and coarse language.
Fancy new band?
Ooh, fancy new band.
Will Neil Finn be there?
Nah, Dave's band though.
Ooh, Dave's band. Fancy.
Fancy new band, Saturday, May 26th at Whammy, Backroom and Wine Cellar. Rudy's, Brewers of Beer.
RNZ reported yesterday that a briefing obtained under the Official Information Act showed that the Ministry of Education advised the government in January that a major step must be taken to accelerate Māori achievement. This step is to address biases against Māori students in schools. I spoke to Miles Ferris, the president of Te Akatea, or the Māori Principals Association, about what, how biases affect Māori students and what step the Ministry of Education must take to increase Māori student achievement. Here is Miles. The Ministry of Education has talked about tackling an unconscious bias against Māori students in schools. What does this bias look like for Māori?
Well, what it looks like is teachers in classrooms having a lower expectation of achievement. There's a lower expectation of their whānau to be engaged in the learning or want to be engaged in the learning. There's a lack of effort when it comes to things like pronouncing Māori names properly, place names. So what it means is that a Māori child walking into any given school will not feel as welcome as those around them.
How does this unconscious bias affect Māori students in their achievement in schools? What are we seeing?
So basically, I mean, there's numerous studies that have shown that teacher expectation is really vital in terms of academic achievement. It's like if I was to sort of expect very little from you, then often that's what you would produce. So, and I think a big issue sits in and around not only that sort of lack of expectation, but a lack of desire from many teachers to actually really develop a strong relationship with that child. And we know in general for our people that relationships are first and foremost. The child needs to know that you as a teacher cares before they're going to open up, before they're going to put in the effort. So when you see a lack of effort back, when you see that your name is not pronounced properly, when you see or hear that there's a lack of real desire to learn more about the culture within the classroom or teaching all of our culture within the classroom, that child just sits back and goes, well, this teacher doesn't care about me, so I'm not going to try. So that's really the basics of it, but it is a complex issue. And there's a lot of things that we need to do to help help teachers change. I want to also say that the majority of teachers I know actually do have a strong passion for and want very much to help their Māori children.
Is it that they don't know how, or is it that they are trying and there's not the resources to be able to develop that achievement and develop that care more?
I think there's a lot of resources available. I think ultimately, part of it is a sense of fear that they don't really know what they're doing, that they don't really know how to do it. So absolutely that. I think many teachers sit back and sort of will turn to the Māori teacher within the school and sort of say, oh, well, you're better than me, so, you do it. But what we need is every teacher in this country to be passionate about developing a knowledge around tikanga and te reo Māori.
Why do you think that some teachers are sort of scared to take on that responsibility and not just push it onto the Māori teacher in the school? Why do you think that's...
I think, as someone who has grown up, my father was hit for speaking Māori in school, so I was never taught it as a young person. I've learned it over the years, but there's always a fear of getting something wrong. I mean, it's a natural fear of doing that. So teachers are no different. They at times feel worried or concerned about whether they're pronouncing a word properly or whether they're teaching something the right way.
It's the unknown, really, isn't it, I suppose? If you haven't been immersed in that culture and had a lot of it while you were growing up, it must feel sort of strange to be teaching it to people when you feel like you don't know yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think, you look at other subjects, there are a lot of teachers out there who don't like teaching maths or they don't like teaching science.
Which I can understand.
Yeah. So, they don't necessarily, push that particular subject as hard as the one that they know and that they're passionate about. So there is an aspect of that, but ultimately we have to get over that as an education system. We have to get over it. And my message is that it's not just teachers. Principals need to lead change within the school, so the whole culture and attitude towards te reo Māori tikanga in the classroom is vital, but that comes from the top. So principals need to get on board about developing a more culturally responsive and aware school environment. But likewise, the Ministry of Education needs to support that, and it needs to happen even in their offices. I mean, when I turn up to the National Office of Ministry of Education and I don't even get greeted with a kia ora, when I ring up and on the phone is kia ora, not kia ora. There are things that we need to change at the very top to show everyone underneath that this is really important.
So as the president of the Māori Principals Association, can you say whether this bias exists at both a primary and secondary school level? Is it right across the board?
Oh, I think, it starts at early childhood. It is in primary schools. It is in secondary schools. It is at tertiary education level. I mean, what will be coming out very shortly is a survey that around racism and discrimination of principals from NZEI. And we know that in that survey, obviously I've been a big part of that, we know that there are things like resourcing decisions around schools. I mean, often the Māori school is not planned or prepared. It's something that's driven from within the community. But, you know, a new area in New Zealand only has to have a little bit of population growth, and the ministry's all over it and say, oh, we need a new school here. They identify the land. They provide a huge amount of funding. They turn around and employ the principal, you know, 18 months out from the start of the school. They employ other teachers before the start of the school. That doesn't happen in for Māori schools.
Really?
No. I mean, we have examples in Auckland where a school was, the principal was told on Boxing Day that he was starting the school on the 1st of February. And basically, he got a DP who had to work for 2 weeks without pay before the school started because they wouldn't fund it. Now, yes, it was a small school, but...
shouldn't be those differences.
We should not have those differences. So there's a whole lot of issues that surround the fact that a lot of our Māori children are very... are not diagnosed with special educational needs as early as many of our non-Māori children. So, often that's put down because the child's a naughty child, not necessarily a child that has learning difficulties or has behavioural difficulties stemming from conditions that that child has. So, you know... The problems are huge and varied, and it's going to take a huge amount of effort and willingness by all parties to make that change.
And it's, you were saying before that it needs to come from the very top. We need to see a change from the government, from the Ministry of Education. So what needs to be done to tackle this issue? What do you think would make the change?
Well, I think what is pleasing is from that OIA report that came out on Radio New Zealand, it just shows a willingness. Minister Davis is a former member of Te Akatia, and he is very passionate about creating the conversation that we need to have to identify what needs to happen. There are a number of programs, one of which Te Akatia run, called the Māori Achievement Collaboratives, that works specifically with school leaders. But something similar, things like that, so Te Kotahitanga and Kahikitia went through primary and secondary schools to raise the understanding and awareness of teachers. Those things need to come back and they need to be well funded. The organisations themselves, like Aero, like the Ministry of Education, need to do cultural responsiveness and awareness programs themselves. You know, everyone who's working at the ministry level should be meeting certain standards of understanding around cultural awareness. And until schools change their environment to allow Māori students to feel that they are valued, that they that their culture is respected within the school, and that they are seen as a learner, not as a special educational needs student.
Okay, so could you just briefly sum up why this change in expectation of Māori students and their achievement is important for Māori and for the future of education in New Zealand?
Well, I think for not only the future of education in New Zealand, but the future of you know,
just New Zealand,
all New Zealand,
yeah,
you know, to stop these disparities that are happening, and you know, these high levels of Māori in prisons is we need to educate our children, but children all over will generally only meet our expectations. So if we don't have high expectations from them and for them, they're not going to, you know, they will meet our low expectation if we have it. So it's really important. It's hugely important that all people, from parents, from teachers, from, you know, the ministry, the government, start turning around and going, okay, we haven't done this well. We need to change. We need to have higher, it's not just about higher expectations. We've got to have higher expectations of ourselves. We as a teaching profession need to improve the way that we engage with our Māori whānau and with our Māori children.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
Andrew Little joined me again this week for our regular chat. We discussed his recent visit to Taranaki, where he talked about the consequences of land confiscation with Ngāti Maru, and also the recent visit by Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan. So here is Andrew.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
Recently you met with Ngāti Maru in Taranaki. What was discussed there?
They've had their claim being negotiated. We signed an agreement in principle at the end of last year. over the loss of their lands, the loss of their people. I mean, they are an iwi that was genuinely devastated by the confiscations of the Raupatu and by the impact of colonisation on them. So their population was heavily decreased. They lost a lot of land. So it was an opportunity to go into their area, Te Arohe, and talk to them on their terms just about the impact of historical events on them. It was a very compelling presentation, and it was great to be in the area.
And how important is it for you personally to sort of, as Treaty Negotiations Minister, to get a feeling behind just how devastating the loss was?
Look, to do the job, you need to face up to people and talk to them in their places, in the areas surrounding them that have had such an impact on them. And I think one of the important aspects of Māori culture is that oral tradition, oral historical tradition. That's how they relay the events that have happened to them and the impact of events on them. So it's important, I think, to hear that from them and from their people, and to hear it in a way that they have learned about the history of their iwi, of their hapu, and get a true understanding of it.
Because how bad was the land confiscation in this case?
Well, it was huge. There was the Taranaki confiscations, and in fact, right over to the central North Island, were significant. Hundreds of thousands of hectares of land just taken by kind of government fiat, and then told, well, if you want to bid for it, then you can. But of course, these were people with no means to do so, and so a lot of the land was then turned over either to private owners, to European settlers, or just held by the Crown. A lot of it's now in part of the Dock Estate. I think we respect that, but they are searching for the means to restore their kind of economic base, their economic well-being, and their mana whenua, their mana motuhake, which is the spirit that is so important to them.
And Ngāti Maru and the Crown recently reached a $30 million settlement. Has this been accepted by the iwi, or is there still parts of it that need to be talked over?
You know, there's still a lot of detail to work through. So what the stages of a treaty settlement, the first point of agreement is what we call an agreement in principle. So we talk about the money, we talk about lands that they have a claim on, that they might be able to get back, other sort of cultural matters. Then there's the detailed work about how all this is going to work practically. That leads to a deed that is then initialled, and the final detail is worked through to a deed of settlement. So we're now working through the detail of the agreement in principle, and that involves locating land that might be returned, or the purchase of land that could be funded out of the $30 million agreed payment.
So is a lot of this land held in private hands?
No, I mean, one of the principles of treaty settlements is we don't seek to... Sorry, that's not quite correct. We can purchase privately held land on an open market, willing buyer, willing seller basis. Otherwise, there is land owned by the Crown that can be returned to iwi, but that is seen as an offset against, the money that has been agreed that they would be paid.
Are there any particularly sort of sticky points?
The difficulty for Ngāti Maru is there is very little land available in the area, Crown-owned land, that could be returned. So we're kind of working our way through that. And then, one of the very serious impacts on them is because they had such a loss of population, is a loss of their kind of tikanga for their particular iwi, and their language and their dialect. And so there will be initiatives about restoring that and reaching out to the descendants of their people who dispersed far and wide to restore or rebuild that Ngāti Maru identity.
How important is it that the history behind these settlements are understood, that we don't just kind of look at the settlement and say, yeah, that's it, we need to kind of recognise what happened?
It's a really good question. I think it's a big challenge for us as a country. I find myself now saying, when I meet with iwi and stand up in front of their people, just how privileged I feel about the history of New Zealand that I'm getting and learning about, that certainly I never learned in school and actually haven't read much about either. And it's a much kind of deeper, richer history than anything I've heard or read before. And you, and I sit there thinking, you know, more people should know this. So I think, and I've started raising with officials and across government, saying it's, we're going to have to think about a way that we get these stories told so that all New Zealanders understand why, you know, why treaty settlements are so important to Māori, to various iwi, why they hold out for so long for justice, and why we still have a long journey to walk before we can say that justice has been truly done.
Hopefully that happens soon. So Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan recently visited New Zealand. What was the purpose of his visit?
He's the Foreign Affairs Minister for the United Arab Emirates. He's a bit of a fan of New Zealand, so he's been out here before. He holidays out here, but he's had a couple of official days of activity here. So he's meeting Foreign Minister Winston Peters, he's meeting the Prime Minister, he's meeting other ministers. The UAE, when I was up there early this year, I met with a number of their ministers. They have a particular interest in New Zealand because we're a small country, a bit like them. They are very interested in our education system, interested in our response to, you know, the challenge of climate change. But the significance for me is the personal connection that goes between our two fathers. So my father was a British Army officer posted to parts of what is now the UAE in the mid-1950s, and he worked with Sheikh Abdullah's father, who was Sheikh Zayed, and who later became the first president of the UAE. Sheikh Zayed was a very formidable sort of character. My father formed a very good friendship with him, as they and worked with Sheikh Zayed to stop the Saudis sort of taking a lot of land that was very oil rich. So he had an important role to play. So, and my father and the Sheikh Abdullah's father maintained their friendship. My father, after he retired to teaching, had a number of trips up to the UAE and re-established the friendship. So it's been good to kind of restore the family connection, which was kind of part of his engagement with me while he's been out in New Zealand.
Certainly a small world. Yeah. The United Arab Emirates doesn't have the greatest human rights record. It's not signed up to most international human rights treaties. Did this come up at all?
I spoke about that when I was there in February. I think what we're seeing now is that there is a younger generation of leadership now in the United Arab Emirates, and we're seeing in Saudi Arabia, actually, as they sort of come to terms with, I think, the, you know, the worldwide regard for those, some of those more westernised Middle Eastern states, and an expectation that they will modernise some of their attitudes. So in Saudi Arabia, you know, the new leader there very quickly overturned the ban on women driving and things like that. And the UAE, yeah, they do have a checkered record. They have been really highly dependent on overseas labour to come and, you know, do a lot of the work there, a lot of the construction, a lot of the agricultural sort of work. And they haven't been treated well. And I think they are now realising that as they engage with the rest of the world much more actively as they are doing, that they've got to, you know, do their bit on worldwide human rights.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little. The Wire.
Citizens, to this day in history with Benjamin J. Goldson.
Yes, this day in history takes us back to 1963 for a police crackdown on civil rights activists in Birmingham, Alabama. Led by Reverend Martin Luther King, the marchers had attempted to challenge legal segregation in the Deep South, a state of affairs which had existed for decades.
Oldest Southern problem, born 300 years ago with the introduction of slavery, is that of the Negro. Today in Dixie, there are almost 9 million colored, for the most part still economically insecure. Though here, as everywhere, the Negro finds himself in the lowest of all income levels, he and his race have made a brave struggle to better their lot. Since slavery was abolished, Negro illiteracy has rapidly decreased. And today, more than 80% of the colored population has had some schooling. greatest struggle of the Negro has been against the ravages of disease. Due to the conditions of poverty in which he lives, the incidence of syphilis and malaria, pellagra and tuberculosis is high. A familiar sight, the length and breadth of Dixie is the rural Negro, and the shack which is his home. His chief blessing is living in a land where the climate is moderate. With an income which averages but a few dollars per year, he clothes his family. To feed them, he must depend principally upon whatever he can raise on his patch of ground. Proof that the Negro, given proper food and medical care, can improve himself is found in the records of 88 colored CCC camps. To many a family whose pleasures are few and primitive, there is no greater occasion than Sunday meeting, no greater pleasure than dressing up in going to meeting clothes. For the Southern Negro lives in the faith that no matter what his lot on earth, there is a better life ahead. Second only to Sunday meeting is the colored community's Saturday night. Out of the Southern Negro's song and dance have come melody and rhythm for the entire world. Despite all his poverty and his handicaps, the Negro is proud of the advancement his race is making in the South. Today, 12,000 colored students are enrolled in 80 colleges of their own. Honored and respected by both white and black is the late, great Booker T. Washington, the Negro leader and educator who first brought hope to his people. From Tuskegee, the institute which he founded, are emerging new leaders of a race which scarcely three generations ago was bound in servitude. Here today, the famed scientist Dr. George Washington Carver carries on his research. Born a slave, Dr. Carver has made important discoveries which are being used to the benefit not only of his own race, but the industry and agriculture of all the South.
That was part one of This Day in History. Part two will continue after the break.
Kendrick Lamar is coming to Spark Arena July 19th. And now, due to popular demand, a new show July 20th. Don't miss Kendrick Lamar, Spark Arena July 19th and 20th. Tickets on sale now from livenation.co.nz.
May the 4th is International Sauvignon Blanc Day, and to celebrate, 95 BFM and Villa Maria Estate are teaming up for great times and great wines at the Lula Inn.
Featuring a performance from legendary vocalist Sandy Mill and BFM DJs Tina Turntables and Automatic.
Plus, it's absolutely free.
If you want to win tickets to our exclusive catered BFM pre-party, then just stay tuned to Breakfast, Morning Glory and Drive all this week.
But you've got to have a B-card. Get yours at 95bfm.com/signup.
Want to pursue your academic passions? After some high-level career opportunities? About to finish your undergrad and terrified of the world outside? Wonderful! May 21st to 25th is Postgrad Week at the University of Auckland, and it's packed with information sessions and opportunities for one-on-one advice. Get into the nitty-gritty of postgraduate study and find answers for all your difficult questions. Postgrad Week at the University of Auckland, May 21st to 25th. Register now at postgradweek.ac.nz.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
We now return to This Day in History. When we left off, the African American civil rights movement had gathered pace, especially after the Supreme Court ruled in 1954 that the school system across America had to be desegregated. In Little Rock, Arkansas, nine black students had been enrolled in what had been a white-only school, but were initially blocked by the state militia.
Little Rock, Arkansas, and the first phase of the trouble. The white population are determined to prevent colored students from going to the school their own children attend. Picketing the school, they clash with the police. The law of the land decrees integration of white and colored schoolchildren. But racial feeling still runs high in the southern states of America, as shown by these pictures taken by an amateur cameraman. The law of the land is rejected. A near riot developed, so the police made a number of arrests among the ringleaders of the white pickets. Later, the Central High School, Little Rock Storm Center, was sealed off by orders of the governor, who called out the State National Guard. Colored youngsters arrived under safe conduct by the guards. But no sooner had they arrived than they were off again. Arkansas had evidently decided to make its own laws on the subject of integration. Any colored person anywhere near the school came in for violent abuse, even if they now escaped physical violence. Phase two, President Eisenhower sends 500 troops of the 101st Airborne Division of the United States Army to Little Rock by night. They are to keep order and to see that the law of the land is obeyed. White and colored students to go to the same school. The federal government clamps down on Arkansas. What Governor Forbes proposes to do next, apart from comparing Little Rock with Paris under the Nazis and Budapest under the Russians, remains to be seen.
By the 1960s, the movement had further escalated, with Reverend King feeling emboldened to lead a march through the heart of the Deep South, Alabama, where, on this day in history, 1963, local police from Birmingham City attacked demonstrators with dogs and fire hoses.
I'm very happy to be able to announce that we have come today to the climax of a long struggle for justice, freedom, and human dignity in the city of Birmingham. I say the climax and not the end, for though we have come a long way, there is still a strenuous path before us, and some of it is yet uncharted. Nevertheless, it can now be said that after the great struggle, this day is clearly the moment of a great victory.
On the face of it, at least, the agreement between Negroes and leading white citizens of Birmingham, which the Reverend Martin Luther King announced this afternoon, did appear to be a victory for the month-long campaign of demonstrations he has been leading. It calls for the progressive desegregation of public facilities from lunch counters to restrooms, for better job opportunities for Negroes, for the establishment of new channels of communication between the races, and for the release of those of the 2,400 demonstrators imprisoned, many of them children, who were still in jail. But the lame duck city administration has denounced the agreement. Still, both the Negro and the white negotiators insist tonight that they think it will be implemented, and new demonstrations have been called off until the city acts. Tonight, Attorney General Robert Kennedy said that there would be more racial crises like the one in Birmingham, but the lessons learned there can be used to solve future problems between whites and Negroes. The lesson, Kennedy said, is that the agreement was reached because the people were prepared to sit down and work things out. But the wounds have not healed. And the memories of what may have been this country's most significant collision of the races are both fresh and bitter. The climactic events of the past week in Birmingham are the subject of tonight's eyewitness report. Your correspondent, Charles Collingwood.
Eyewitness, the big news of the week. Witness, breakthrough in Birmingham. Brought to you by L&M, the filter cigarette for people who really like to smoke. L&M in pack or box.
This is Birmingham, the South's mightiest industrial city as the world knew it this week. These are the front lines of the battle between Dr. Martin Luther King's Negro Disciples of Nonviolence and the uniformed forces of Birmingham, led by Commissioner Eugene Bull Connor, who says, "We were trying to be nice to them, but they won't let us be." The Negro leaders say this will lay the whole issue before the conscience of the community and the nation. The scene is last Saturday. The sights and sounds filmed and recorded as they happened. The place is near the 16th Street Baptist Church, the starting point for Negro demonstrations.
That was This Day in History.
Thank you, Ben, for another very informative This Day in History.
Welcome.
A bit grim,
yeah.
But, you know,
but
it is every week, isn't it?
Culminated in the Civil Rights Act of 1964, but a bonus history.
Well, history's a bit grim, isn't it? How's our poll doing?
Our poll is doing well.
Mm-hmm. Retweeted by David Slack, by the way, everyone.
So, will the peace talks in Korea lead to? 47% said nothing, 50% have said denuclearization, 17% have said reunification, and 6% have said something else, but no replies.
I think I'd tend to lean towards the nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah, what do you two reckon?
You'd like to hope that it would be something better than
nothing.
Well,
live in eternal hope.
Mm.
Yeah, well, okay, but for now.
That was The Wire.
Yes, that brings us to the end of our show for another week. A big thank you to everyone who spoke to us today. Catherine Geringer, Miles Ferris, and Andrew Little. Thank you to Ben and Jemima.
Hey. Thank you, Lachlan. Hey.
And up next is Sam with the 1 to 4.
Was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.